This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Robert M. Gates joins us for this Forum segment. Secretary of Defense under both Presidents Bush II and Obama from 2006 to 2011. He also served as an officer in the United States Air Force and as director of the Central Intelligence Agency under President George H.W. Bush. He was a member of the National Security Council staff in four administrations and is currently chancellor of William & Mary College. And in January, he published Duty, Memoirs of a Secretary at War. He joins us for the second segment. Secretary Gates, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
We just spoke with Stephen Cohen about Ukraine, and I'd like your take, obviously. I'm fairly certain you're not necessarily in agreement with him, but you did say publicly that Putin holds most of the high cards, in Ukraine and in Crimea, which has now been annexed. So the U.S. policy should reinforce neighboring state security.
Well, that's correct. I think that what Putin is up to is a longer-term strategy of recreating a buffer along Russia's borders of states that used to be part of the Russian Empire or the Soviet Union. He doesn't want to recreate the Soviet Union, but he wants those states to look to Moscow politically, economically, and in terms of foreign policy and national security. And I think he is determined to do that. He's playing a long game. He's willing to be patient. And he has a lot of tools at his disposal. I think that we don't have really any significant short-term options. What I think we can do is by reinforcing our NATO allies in Europe, particularly Poland and the Baltic states, and also turning up the heat economically, at least make sure that he doesn't try to ensure that he doesn't make any new moves, for example, in the Baltic states that are heavily dependent on Russia economically. I think he sees it as a historical mission to extend Russia's protection to those Russians who were part of the Russian Empire or part of the Soviet Union and who now live in other states. And obviously this has considerable dangers for the future if he continues to pursue that line.
Well, it prompts me to ask you a question about, I want to go right to your book here, because among the controversial things that appear in your book, you mentioned that Vice President Biden is a man of integrity, but was wrong on nearly every foreign policy and national security issue of the past four decades, and he's going to Ukraine today. How does that bode in your mind?
Well, I think it's an important gesture of support for the Ukrainians that he's there. I think it's unrelated in many in most respects to sort of the past in terms of his record with respect to the Soviet Union and so on. But I'm, frankly, I'm glad he's there.
And what about you're saying that, and you are still, I guess, a registered Republican, the Republicans ought to cool the criticism of President Obama on the Ukraine. A lot of that criticism, though, has come down to the fact that they see Putin as a kind of, almost demonizing him in some ways as this brilliant chess player with the designs on, as you indicated earlier, perhaps even the Baltic or the old USSR versus President Obama being characterized over and over again as being weak.
Well, I think I have said that I thought Republicans ought to tone it down. I first went into the government almost 50 years ago, and even in those days in Vietnam, but especially elsewhere, there was a certain sense that party politics stopped at the water's edge, and particularly when the president is dealing with an ongoing crisis, I think all the kibitzing, frankly, just makes it harder. It undermines him and his dealings with other leaders, including Putin. There'll be plenty of time for criticism later, and I'm not sure that it's – I just don't think it's particularly helpful right now.
I did get the sense, though, from your book that there was real criticism of the kind of party politics that were operating and hovering over decisions in Afghanistan, particularly when it came to sending more enablers or more troops to Afghanistan.
Well, I described in our debates in the Obama administration toward the end of 2009 that political issues did come up in that discussion, but I'm very explicit in the book that that in the at the end of the day, the president made decisions that he thought were in the best interest of the country and went against the advice of his political advisors and staffers in the White House. He put the politics aside and did what he thought was in the best interest of the country.
I was struck, though, by, for example, you're talking about a number of moments where you were quite angry and seething and blood boiling, all of those kinds of things, though you kept the mask pretty secure of being the Comms Secretary of Defense. One of the things I was particularly struck by was remarks about National Security Advisor Tom Donilon, especially on Haiti relief. I think you even said that was the angriest you were. And yet Tom Donnelly has said that he got on great with you and aired all the differences and everything was hunky-dory.
That's all true. I did get very angry with Tom. We were in a large meeting in the Oval Office talking about Haiti. And in front of a large group of people, Tom openly questioned the competence of the four-star general who was in charge of the relief effort. And I thought that in that kind of a setting, it was totally inappropriate. By the same token, Tom and I had a very good working relationship after he became National Security Advisor. He and I had a session, got together and aired things out, and we had a strong working relationship for the rest of the time I was Secretary of Defense.
But I believe you also said that this was the most centralized and controlling administration on national security since Richard Nixon and Secretary of State Kissinger.
That's correct.
Can I ask you to elaborate on that?
Well, the thing that offended me the most was the interference in day-to-day military operations and calls from the White House staff to and National Security Council staff to commanders in the field and to combatant commanders. I worked under three national security advisors, Kissinger, Brzezinski, and Scowcroft, and as I write in the book, under any of those three national security advisors or the presidents they worked for, such an action on the part of a White House staffer or NSC staffer would have been probably grounds for being fired.
And where do you see the U.S. now in terms of Afghanistan? I mean, I believe you said, and most Americans would agree with it, with your statements about it has to be no longer an extremist safe haven under any circumstances, and we have to build our security forces. Are you at least somewhat sanguine about this election where Karzai will no longer be in charge?
Well, I wouldn't say I'm sanguine, but I would say I'm modestly optimistic. I think that the turnout in the election, despite Taliban efforts to terrorize and prevent people from voting, the turnout was substantial, greater by percentages than in our presidential elections. The front runners are both men who have pledged to work with the United States and our allies. They both have pledged to sign the security agreement that would keep a modest number of U.S. and our allied troops there to provide counterterrorism help and intelligence, logistics, and training, and so on. And I would say that the Afghan army has acquitted itself reasonably well over the past number of months. They're now basically in control of security for virtually all of the country. So I think that particularly with the outcome of this election and the prospects for having that security agreement signed, that all of the sacrifice that has been made will prove worthwhile.
We're talking with Robert M. Gates, former Secretary of Defense, who served under President George W. Bush and President Obama from 2006 to 2011. He's also former director of the Central Intelligence, and his latest book is called Duty, Memoirs of a Secretary at War, which is now out and available in paperback. There was a sense in your book, Secretary Gates, though, of interference by the Obama administration with the chain of command, and not necessarily, well, how shall I put this? Perhaps maybe more from President Obama's advisors, but a distrust of military advisors, which certainly wouldn't be said about the Bush administration. Bush administration often looked toward the generals. I mean, in that sense, it must have been a great adjustment for you, I would think.
Well, first of all, both presidents, as with most of their predecessors, were quite willing to disagree with the generals. And that's entirely appropriate. That's the role of the commander-in-chief. President Bush overruled them when he decided on the surge in Iraq. President Obama went against their advice in terms of the size of the surge in Afghanistan and in putting dates on when the withdrawal would begin. I agreed with all of those decisions, and I thought that and so I thought the fact that they disagreed with the generals, I think, is a healthy thing, and there's a signature element of the way American government works and civilian control of the military. I think that there was suspicion of the motives of the military officers in the Obama White House, and I think particularly on the part of the vice president and ultimately on the part of the president, that these generals were trying to jam him on Afghanistan in terms of boxing him into a certain set of decisions, forcing a decision when he had hoped not to have to make another one in terms of adding troops. I argued long and hard with him that that was not the case, that it was not a conspiracy, that they were not trying to do that, but that their concerns and their positions were genuine. And I think he had good, the relationship was quite civil. He gave the generals all the time they wanted to present their case to him. He was always willing to listen to them, just like President Bush. But he wasn't afraid to disagree with him, and I applauded that.
Again, if you've just joined us, we're talking former Secretary of Defense Robert M. Gates, and we invite you to join us on this program. You can do that now at our toll-free number, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. The number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. Again, toll-free from wherever you're listening, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQEDForum. We're going to go to your calls and emails in just a moment here. I want to ask Secretary Gates, though, in duty, you say you were kind of blindsided, along with head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Mullen, on Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Can I get you to clarify that?
Well, we began discussing getting rid of Don't Ask, Don't Tell with the president as early as April 2009, just two or three months into his term as president. And we had discussed it in general terms, and where I talked about being blindsided was his decision to include a commitment to doing that in a specific time frame in the State of the Union address in January of 2010, and where we learned only a matter of hours before the State of the Union, a day before perhaps, that he intended to do this, which really gave us virtually no opportunity to inform, much less consult with the leaders of the military services.
Alyssa,
as the book details, we worked very hard in the ensuing months to ensure that we could go forward with getting rid of the law, and then and to train the force so that there would be no incidents once the law was changed.
I'm going to go to an online comment now, Secretary Gates, from a listener named Colin, who says, Secretary Gates once remarked that the goal of the U.S. mission in Afghanistan should not be to create a Central Asian Valhalla. If that wasn't the goal, then what purpose has the 12-year occupation or military presence in Afghanistan served? Have the objectives of the mission been met?
Well, I think that the objectives of the original mission have been met in the sense that the prospect today is reasonably good. Again, I'm modestly optimistic that you will have an Afghan government that has the capability to keep the Taliban from retaking power and keeping extremist groups from using Afghanistan as a launching pad again. Frankly, I believe that that in the years after 2001, our objectives expanded and became unrealistic in terms of creating a more competent and less corrupt government in Kabul, more of a long-term democratic state in terms of economic reform and so on. I think those things are all possible, but that's the work of decades. And so as I detail in the book, my objective was to narrow our objectives back to what the original intent had been, which was simply a security one, of making sure that Afghanistan couldn't become a place to launch attacks against the United States again.
Talking to Robert Gates, author of Duty, Memoirs of a Secretary at War, and let's bring in a caller. Phil, that's you. You're on forum. Good morning.
Hi. I hope Secretary Gates runs for president, by the way. The reason I'm calling is, you know, it seems like Putin and Russia is really dominated by, you know, criminal gangs. He got rid of the governors. You know, now he's trying to reacquire lands that Stalin had established majority Russians in. I mean, isn't this just a resurgence of fascism or autocracy, you know, versus Western capitalism? And if so, I mean, I know NATO and Europe shouldn't have gotten involved by saying, you know, us or Russia, and that precipitated the war. But, you know, won't we just run into this problem over and over again with them for domestic Russian politics?
Robert Gates.
Well, I think you put your finger on one concern, and that is that the way Putin is talking about his new mission, the way he is talking about Crimea and eastern Ukraine as New Russia, which was a term that goes back to imperial days, suggests a sort of, and also his speech where he talks about about Russian values being different than Western values, and that they don't subscribe to Western ways of thinking about problems in a whole bunch of different ways. I think all of that's very worrisome in terms of his mindset and this sense of historical mission that he has. I mean, my own view is that when Medvedev was president, I had the sense that he understood Russia's problems and the importance of tying Russia closer to the West, getting more foreign investment, and moving more toward a state of law or a rule of law in Russia. I don't think Putin believes in any of that. And as I write in the book, I looked into Putin's eyes and I saw a stone cold killer.
Unlike George Bush, who saw his soul. But couldn't we, in fact, I think this is a point that Stephen Cohen makes in his article, The Nation. We spoke with him in the previous half hour. He says maybe we need to meet Putin halfway like Ronald Reagan did with Gorbachev.
Well, I think what, you know, the question is, what's halfway for Putin? If you don't know what Putin's goals are, you don't know what halfway is. His halfway, does that include the Baltic states? You know, and what are the lessons of him getting away with satisfying old revanchist claims in the Crimea and in Ukraine? What are the implications of that and the Western reaction for what's going on between China and Japan or China and the Southeast Asian nations? The question is, he is trying to upend the old or the post-Cold War order in which there was general agreement that borders would only be changed through negotiation and consent of all of those involved, in which countries would have the right to choose with which other countries they wanted to have economic and security and other kinds of relationships, and that old revanchist claims would be settled by negotiation. He's violated every single one of those. That's why what's happened in Crimea and that's what's happening in eastern Ukraine makes a difference.
Just for the record from that last call, you are not planning on running for the presidency, I assume.
Not a chance.
Actually, from reading your book, it sounds like you would be certainly, satisfied may be too strong a word, but you would not be unhappy if Hillary Clinton were elected president.
Well, I think that Secretary Clinton was a strong Secretary of State. She and I worked well together. I thought she was very tough-minded, very realistic. At the same time, she was idealistic, but pragmatic.
But also
she
political.
She had a great sense of humor.
She was. You also bring to question her politics in terms of war opposition when she was running for the against President Obama.
Well, you know, I don't think it's any great revelation to say that politicians say one thing when they're running for office and maybe say and do things differently when they actually have the responsibility.
Let me bring another caller on. And that's you, Richard. You're on. Good morning.
Thank you. I would like to ask Secretary Gates, if he has any comment about in Tom Ricks's book, The Generals. He points out that in the days of General Marshall, generals tend to be fired for incompetence within the Army. but that has tended not to happen since. And there's a wonderful quote from the book from an American colonel in the Iraq War who said that as matters stand now, a private who loses a rifle suffers a far greater consequence than a general who loses a war.
Yeah, Tom Ricks did make that statement, Secretary Gates.
No,
well, I think, first of all, I'm the first Secretary of Defense to fire, or the first civilian leader of the military to fire a commander in the field since President Truman fired MacArthur. So when I fired General McKiernan, it wasn't because he'd done anything bad. It was that I didn't think that he was the right general to continue prosecuting the war. And one of the points that Ricks makes and that others make is that it wasn't a career ender sometimes when a division commander or a commander would be relieved in World War II, nor was it considered an insult to the Army. It was just generally appreciated that you had to have the right commanders in the right place, and that's the way I felt. While I was secretary, I fired the chief of staff of the Air Force and the secretary of the Air Force because of lapses in nuclear security. I fired the Secretary of the Army and the Surgeon General of the Army over the scandal in Walter Reed. So I had no reluctance whatsoever to relieve commanders or fire people if I felt they should be held accountable for things that had gone wrong.
Let me thank the caller and read a listener's remark from Facebook. Listener named Ken writes, the U.S. military is continually carrying out secret strikes, torturing and killing innocent people, and then lying about those actions to the American people from the Vietnam era through the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. Why does former Secretary Gates think this culture of lies, failure, cover-up, and eventual exposure is such a part of the U.S. military? And shouldn't we consider that anything said from people of that era is a possible yellow cake, uranium-sized lie?
Well, I just disagree with that. I think that first of all, I don't think that there was clearly abuse of prisoners at Abu Ghraib, and but I think that that the U.S. military has conducted itself in the middle of two wars with great honor, and there are outliers, people who have done things that have been against the wishes of their commanders and have been against the rules. And when those have been found out, those people have been put on trial and punished. I think you will not find another institution in America where you have more people with greater honor and integrity than in the U.S. military.
But you write very poignantly about the impact of going to hospitals and seeing wounded soldiers had on you, going to cemeteries, meeting with families and so forth. It's actually very sensitive and compelling writing. What I found myself wondering was, when you look back, I suppose you could in some ways justify the way President Obama did Afghanistan as a necessary war, but it's very difficult for many Americans of all different kinds of colors to justify the war in Iraq, particularly since there were no weapons of mass destruction other than perhaps removing Saddam Hussein. But we could remove dictators from so many different countries. So when you look back on Iraq, your thoughts are what? Necessary?
I was in the very strange position as Secretary of Defense of having to fight and try and extract ourselves, our country, from two wars, neither of which I had any role in starting. And I think, as I've said often publicly, that the war in Iraq will always be tainted by the fact that it was sold to the American people on wrong information, the notion that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. Now, never mind that most countries in the world, including Russia and China, thought that that was true, partly because Saddam wanted them to believe it was true. It still was wrong information, and there's no doubt about that. And I think that at that point, the goals shifted to the idea of turning Iraq into a democracy and so on. And I say right at the outset of the book, I think there were some huge mistakes and miscalculations made, particularly in the first couple of years in Iraq, that contributed to the prolonged war that we ended up in. So, I think we handed the Iraqis a country in 2008, 2009. Where we had restored stability and security to a considerable extent. They had a rudimentary, if flawed, democracy, in a multi-ethnic, multi-religious state. And I think American service people who served can take satisfaction in our having reached a point with our military operations and our civilians where we could hand over Iraq like that. But nothing gets frozen in time in history, and the Iraqis have made some significant mistakes since we left, and that has contributed to a lot of the problems that they face today, not to mention the spillover from Syria. But
you don't think we should have gotten out sooner? I mean, certainly that's an argument that we keep hearing about Vietnam, that we should have gotten out sooner.
Well, I think that my view was how do we extract ourselves from Iraq in a way that doesn't have long-term and global consequences, and that was my philosophy when I became secretary in December of 2006, and it basically governed my decisions and my recommendations for the next couple of years. How do we bring this to a close, but in a way that doesn't further damage our standing and our ability to conduct our national security affairs internationally?
You were there 5 years as Secretary of Defense in two administrations. Certainly, you didn't necessarily have any love for the job. What do you remember with real fondness in terms, or for that matter, pride?
All the interaction with the troops, and I think the thing that made me proudest was when I was once characterized as the soldier's secretary, because I had took the job, came to feel very quickly that I had a personal responsibility for the well-being of everybody who was fighting in those wars, and I really had to push through a lot of measures, from heavier armor to intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, accelerated medevac, and a variety of other programs to get the troops the equipment they needed to protect themselves and get home safely, as well as accomplish their mission. And if they were hurt, to make sure they got the best care in the world. And we're still struggling with the latter, but I'm very proud of what I was able to do to help protect the troops while they were there.
Secretary Gates, good to have you with us. Thank you for joining us on Forum this morning.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And his book, now in paperback, is out, and it's called Duty, Memoirs of a Secretary at War. When we come back, after the news, we're going to talk with Mayor Ed Lee, Mayor of San Francisco. You're listening to Forum on KQED. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.